from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Economists say you should spend no more than a third of your paycheck on rent. More than that spells trouble on all the other bills. And forget about saving to buy a home. But today, an estimated half of this country's renters are paying more than 30% of their wages on rent. A quarter are paying more than half their wages. It's a big problem with big implications. This hour on Point, American rents and why they're now sky high. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How much of your paycheck is going to rent? And why have rental rates spiked? Where's the law of supply and demand when you need it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, who's attracted national attention for his big campaign to keep rents affordable in the hot Seattle economy. But first, joining me from Washington is Neela Richardson, formerly research economist at Freddie Mac, Bloomberg, Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies, now chief economist at the national real estate brokerage firm Redfin. She watches what's going on in the housing market in this country very closely. Neela Richardson, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
People always complain about the rent. Are things different now? Is there a problem?
Yes, and yes, the rent is much higher now. In fact, rental prices are increasing at 3.5% annually. That's the fastest pace we've seen in 30 years. So if you feel like your rent is too high, you are correct, it is.
What has driven rents up, and in what time period have they been driven up?
You know, it's you mentioned in the intro supply and demand, and that's really part of this conundrum. The fact is rental households have increased a lot, 9 million new renters over the past 10 years, and yet supply has not kept pace. Building and new construction is way undersupplied in this country. Part of the reason is because of the housing boom and bust, and the simple fact is apartment building has not kept up with the demand.
Why the surge in the number of people renting instead of buying, or you name it?
Some of it's demographic, some of it's economic, and some of it's regulation. So it's a great conundrum of three big factors. You know, we've seen an increase in renter households across demographics. It's not just millennials moving out of their parents' basements, it's Gen Xers. And the largest group of new renters are baby boomers. One of the reasons is because of the impact of the housing crisis, 8 million foreclosures. That led a lot of people to seek rental housing. The housing market, the for sale market, hasn't recovered. A lot of people can't get a mortgage still. A lot of people haven't seen a lot of wage growth. And so they are renters, sometimes by choice, sometimes by circumstance. And so that's one of the reasons that's keeping that rental demand really, really high.
Now, you would think historically that that would mean kind of pent-up demand to buy homes, or if there were so many renters, people would build rental units like crazy. Mm-hmm. Why aren't those things happening to be a relief valve on this?
Yeah, you would think. Well, in the for sale market, market I know well, there is a supply shortage here too. There's simply not enough affordable homes for sale. And also, it's been really hard to get a mortgage. Banks were very shy to extend credit after being burnt so badly in 2007 and 8 during the housing downturn. And they've been slow to extend credit. Builders too have had a hard time getting financing. And that's one of the reasons that they've been slow to start up supply, even though there's so much demand. And when apartment buildings are being built, a lot of times it's in urban centers for high-income renters.
We've heard a lot about millennials not being as drawn to home ownership as their parents. Is that part of what's going on here? People, there's more demand to rent. People just don't want to buy. And is that coming back to bite them?
That's some of the reason. I mean, millennials tend to they're delaying all kinds of life choices, marriage, family, and those. It's really children that get you out of an apartment into a house and seeking a yard. So we all
can't
know
take
that.
It. Got to have more room.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so if millennials are delaying families, there's less incentive to really move out. Also, they're facing they enter the job market in a pretty flat economy. We're seeing improvement, but it takes a while to save for that down payment, especially if you're spending more than a third of your income or more on the rent.
What happens to people who get up well over that third, or even we're finding, I'm seeing numbers you've been citing here, something like a quarter of people spending more than half of their income on rent. What's the knock-on effect of that?
Well, it means basically simple. They have less money to spend on other things like education, like down payment for homes, like health care. It has huge effects, especially when you look at many of the households who are extremely cost-burdened, who are paying more than 50% of their incomes in rent, are seniors, those most vulnerable in society. And so it's really becoming a growing epidemic in terms of the housing market.
Can we go back to the builders? When rents are so high, that must make it awfully attractive because you think, I can build rental units and charge a good rate and be in Fat City. Pick that apart, why they're not rushing in to do that if that opportunity is sitting there and people are, it may hurt, but people are paying.
Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of them is just financing has been difficult, though we've seen more financing recently. What builders have done is chased where the high income demand is. And so you see some building in urban centers like Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. like Seattle, targeted towards high income renters. You've seen less low income building and affordable building. And that's really where the need is. But also, this is a problem that has many places to point the finger. And one of them is for those who advocate against density. There are a lot of local governments and local citizens who don't want a high rise in their backyard. And they have been very successful in keeping it out. And so that is another question that has to be confronted. There's only so much a builder can do if regulation prevents them from starting an apartment building.
We heard one of your colleagues talking about even a lack of skilled labor to build new housing. Can that really be true? I mean, carpentry seems like maybe something out there on the high end of, computer chips. But carpentry? Surely we've got enough carpenters in this country who could use a job.
We're still feeling the effects of that housing bust, the worst since the Great Depression, and it has long lasting effects. One of them is that highly skilled construction workers took those skills elsewhere and they left. And that's why you see so many in the real estate industry in favor of immigration, because they need skilled workers and they need to draw back people who left the industry altogether.
We heard a lot as well back when the housing crisis hit about people buying up properties that maybe they've turned into rental units. Some mom-and-pop buyers, but also big private equity companies, BlackRock and others, buying thousands, tens of thousands of housing units, homes across the country. How much an effect did that have? What are those big property owners with lots and lots of units now doing with those?
Real estate is a market that it's been blamed for having very little innovation. This was a big change. The fact that institutional investors were buying up single-family homes and converting them into rentals is a big change in the rental market. And it's done a couple of things. It's actually met a demand for people who would like to have a house but can't afford a mortgage or can't get a mortgage. And so it's serving some need. But it's also taking a lot of affordable properties out of the for sale market. So it's causing a dip in supply as well.
So you get more pressure there. And then there's the whole question when people are spending a third or more than half of their income on rent. Maybe it's because the rents are high, but maybe it's because the incomes aren't. How does that come in?
Incomes haven't kept up with inflation. So this is like another, part of this conundrum. Household incomes are actually back at 1990s levels. That's the sad truth. And so as rents are rising, incomes have not kept pace, especially for low income and people in the middle class income bracket. And so there's this big mismatch between wage growth and rental prices.
It makes it look to me as though that means you've got a lot of people just trapped here. Incomes aren't great, but somehow the law of supply and demand is not keeping rents down. They're making less, they're paying more, and there's not a clear way out of it.
So we've successfully made this a very dismal problem. There is some good news, and I the point is accurate, and that's why we need more attention paid to it, especially on the political part of it, because regulation is a big component of the supply. But I will say that multifamily building has picked up.
Good.
It is getting stronger, and yet we still need federal and local laws to keep pace with this issue.
Local mainly around zoning to make it possible for more density?
We think so. Zoning is an important part, and that's what gives me optimism. So many of our economic problems are out of reach in terms of local governments and local neighborhoods. This is a problem that has a local solution. The problem is that a lot of neighbors, a lot of community members don't want density in their backyard. But if that mindset could change, I think we could solve this problem much quicker than simply relying on supply and demand to do it for us.
This whole situation is a problem for people, for families, young families, or just young renters, anybody who's trapped in here. What about for the economy, for the country overall, when people are being squeezed this hard on the rental front? What are the implications?
So it's not just a local problem, even though it has a local solution. And for the first time in decades, we are seeing people leave where jobs are being created because they can't afford the rent. And that's a big deal.
Places like
San Francisco, Seattle. Mayor Murray has been on top of this issue, and he is one of those people who are working to bring in affordable housing, but places that are creating jobs, Boston, rents are still too high, and it makes it really hard for middle-class workers to stay in the cities where the job opportunities are.
Can you just move to escape this problem? Is there some place in America that's a nirvana of cheap rent rates?
Oh, sure. There are pockets of places where rents are still affordable. The question is, do job opportunities also follow? And the mismatch between where opportunities are and where affordability is growing ever more. You know, when you have to take 50 bus stops to get to a job interview, that's an issue no matter how low your rent is. It blocks you from economic opportunity. And that has macro effects, not just for the individual, but for the country as a whole.
I'm looking at a list here of places where people are severely rent burdened, and it's all over. Jacksonville, Richmond, Virginia, Hartford, Orlando, Virginia Beach, Sacramento, California, LA, of course, Providence, Rhode Island, New Orleans. That's a lot of terrain. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about American rents, why they're sky high, and what's going on with the American housing market. Too many now paying more than half their income on rent. Neela Richardson is with us, chief economist at Redfin National Real Estate Brokerage, joins us from Washington. We'll hear in just a moment from the mayor of Seattle, Ed Murray, where they have jumped in very aggressively to try and wrestle with this issue. You can join us this hour. How are the rates, the rental rates in your area? What's the trend? If it's up a lot, what do you see driving it up? And are you paying more of your paycheck in rent? How big a bite is the rent taking these days? Builders, if the market's so strong, why aren't you building more apartments, more houses? Neela Richardson, please stand by in Washington. With us right now from Seattle in Washington State, Ed Murray, mayor of Seattle since January of 2014. He was a Washington State senator from 2007 to 13, served before that in the State House of Representatives for 11 years. He's been taking big steps on housing in Seattle. Mayor Murray, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
What pushed you, what drove you to grapple with this issue?
Seattle is now one of the five fastest growing cities in America. The economy is great. But in that, the downside of that has been the issue of affordability, that folks who work in the city less and less can't afford to live in the city. And so our challenge was to try and find a way to address what's going on in this city and up and down the cities of the West Coast.
Who's been having trouble? The poor, the middle class, both?
It's really across the spectrum. It's middle class. It's the working poor. It's those folks who are you know, homeless. Like other cities up and down the West Coast, we have a growing homeless crisis.
What drove, I guess, your housing stock or the rental rates out of whack in the first place?
Well, I think when you have a market as hot as Seattle's has, and as I said, we're growing fast. Jobs are great. Unemployment is low. People have great salaries. We have a large part of the city that is zoned single family, so the pressure starts to build.
And there you are. Why didn't this just take place without your intervention? I mean, you've put together a big campaign. What about supply and demand?
Well, part of it is getting those market forces right. And we put together a group of folks from low-income housing advocates, neighborhood advocates, and developers, among others. And they spent over half a year, and they came up with over 60 recommendations that we're now in the process of moving through council, trying to get approval through the legislature, everything from mandatory inclusionary zoning, which if you build a multifamily unit, you build affordable units, which will be the first time that in this city that the private sector builds those units. We'll double what is the Seattle housing levy that has been in place for 35 years. So it's a whole series of things that we're going to do.
Did you and other people in Seattle see the character of the city begin to change as this high rent pressure set in, the lack of affordable housing?
Yeah, and I, having grown up here and as a kid in what was then a basically working class neighborhood, one of the points I make again and again is we were losing characteristics of our neighborhoods, and one of them was that they were mixed income, that they were affordable, that people from different economic groups were lived together in the same neighborhoods, and that does change the texture and the feel of the city, and that's what we are, you know, anxiously trying to preserve and get back to.
I mean, we've all seen the pictures of Bill Gates' gigantic house and others around Seattle. It's not as if nothing's been built. I guess Microsoft and all the other sort of hot economy jobs there must have brought high-end housing.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of high-end housing. Again, that tends to be not just in the high-end housing in the city's condos, outside the city in the suburbs, it's you know, the large houses. Again, our goal is what do we do to preserve the affordable stock we have, and we're working on things such as tax credits for folks to redevelop their apartment buildings and not just toss people out and raise the rents, things such as a housing levy. And this agreement we reach between developers and low-income housing advocates so that we were able to get the developers to withdraw their lawsuits.
Everybody talks about that, about your grand bargain. How did you get developers to cooperate here? Because, you know, across the country, Neela Richardson and others talked to us about how, well, developers were very happy to build high-end housing. There was a big market, big margins for that. How did you get them interested, committed, I guess is where you're headed, to middle and lower-income housing?
Well, I think I'm lucky to be mayor of a city where people actually want to do the right thing and want to help folks who are struggling. So I think that helped me. Secondly, I think I'm also lucky to be a mayor of a city where the culture is a little indirect. So by me putting people in the same room and getting them talking, it was easy to do. But I think the big difference was that this was going to end up in court or was going to end up in a bunch of, you know, ballot measures on the ballot, advocates putting ballot measures on the ballot, developers going to court, and that wasn't going to build any housing for anybody.
Neela Richardson, you must have been watching Mayor Murray in Seattle and others around the country trying to take this on. What do you think of the strategy that they've come up with in Seattle to try and address super high rents?
I think it's one of the places where you are seeing some bright lights at the end of the tunnel. And I also think it illustrates what it takes to get supply back into housing. It takes a bargain with developers. It takes advocacy groups. It takes a lot of people in local governments making this a priority. In Seattle, in the for sale market, the number of homes for sale is 34% lower in this year than it was last year. And that trickles down all the way through to rental. It's a big problem, and it's good to see that they're addressing it and embracing the problem, trying to find solutions.
Mayor Murray, why so few homes for sale? That seems to be almost a different problem, or maybe it's related to high rent.
Well, you know, Seattle, for the first time in a century, is growing faster than its surrounding suburbs. It used to be that the jobs went to the suburbs. Now the jobs are coming right to Seattle. Amazon developed in the heart of the city. Expedia is moving its corporate headquarters here. There are startups from one end of the city to the next. That's what's really driving, that's one of the things that's really driving this. The other is, of course, the issue of income inequality. But when you have a market that hot, in a city that is zoned over 60% single family, there are going to be very few options.
And now I'm reading you here saying you've got about 45,000 households in Seattle that spend more than half their incomes on housing. That is high. We've got calls for you and Neela Richardson. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Carol, thanks for calling. You're on with Mayor Ed Murray in Seattle.
Hi, Tom. I work in the industry in Austin, Texas.
The industry being real estate, Carol?
Real estate. I work in real estate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we have criteria in place where we don't rent to anyone that their income is less than one-third of the rent. So we have that criteria. My company refuses to, we don't do
that. You don't want them to spend more than a third of what they make on rent. How's that working?
It works great because, well, if say it works great, it doesn't really work great because I've moved myself out of the city because I can no longer afford to live there.
There you go.
My investors buy homes, single-family homes up cash. Then we raise the rent by $200 for the next renter. Austin economy booming. We have 100-some-odd people moving here every day, but I can't afford to live in the city, even working in the industry.
So is your company thinking about dropping that requirement that you'd not take tenants who can't afford, who are going to have to spend more than a third of their income? Is that possible to keep up?
We are not. We're not because the jobs are so great. People can afford to do that. Some people that work at Google and Apple and Oracle and we have Visa here, we have National Instruments. So they can afford those prices. So we're not going to drop those at all.
And of course not everybody can work at Google and Apple. Carol, I appreciate your call from Austin. Neela Richardson, there's Carol in the business. And you hear she's working with these guidelines, but she herself can no longer afford to be in that location.
It's striking. Redfin is headquartered in Seattle, and we care about the livability of Seattle, but we operate also in Austin. And what we're seeing across West Coast cities is that these highly paid tech workers are moving to places like Austin because they can't afford the rents in San Francisco and other West Coast cities. And what's that done is really create an environment in places like Austin, other cities that used to be affordable, in which the rent has become again high. So this is a problem that's moving from the West Coast to the East Coast. And that caller was a perfect example of that eastern migration of high West Coast rental prices.
Let me get a little full East Coast input here, and I'll bring it to you, Mayor Murray. Cheryl in Milford, Connecticut. Cheryl, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, we live in an area where we're not too far from New York City, and there's a train station. I mean, it's actually more like an hour and a half, 2 hours train ride, but the rentals have gone up exponentially in the past 5 years. I actually rent out an apartment, and 5 years ago I was getting like $500 for it, and the last time I tried to rent it, there was a bidding war going on for it, and it's renting now for $1,000, and it's nothing special.
How many square feet is that, Cheryl? Roughly,
probably about 1,500 square feet, but it's a second story walk up, and it's got barely a kitchen and a teeny tiny bathroom, and
a 2 hour train commute from New York. If that's what you're interested in, that's a long way.
Yeah, but people can't. Fairfield County is in a very expensive county, and so people are moving to New Haven County.
Yeah,
and if you're anywhere near the train, or you can, get a pass for the train, they'll pay just about anything. And the builders are building like crazy, but the rent prices just aren't going down at all.
And boom, up goes the rent, doubling in just a handful of years there. Cheryl, I appreciate your call. Mayor Murray, what are you thinking as you hear these stories out of Connecticut, out of Austin, Texas, up and up?
Yes. So I think, you asked me what we did in Seattle, and we were able to reach an agreement between developers and housing, low-income housing advocates. Cities can be incubators of these approaches, but what you just heard is somebody who lives, sounds like not just in the suburbs, but maybe the outer suburbs. And the last time we had a housing crisis of this type in this nation was at the end of World War II. In the middle class was able to afford housing because of an aggressive federal housing program. Mm-hmm. The federal government is missing in action on this one. So Seattle can be creative, Austin, New York, Boston, I know San Francisco, we're all working on how we can be innovative. But without the federal government once again stepping in, these things can't be taken to scale.
What do you want from them? I mean, we've barely heard this discussed on the primary presidential campaign trail. If it were, what would you like to hear?
Well, I think it's an amazing an appalling thing that has not been discussed in the debates almost at all. If you look at the money from the federal government for affordable housing at beginning in the early 80s today, it just went through, you know, the floor and the basement and everything else. It was just cut, 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 cut. And that's affordable housing. That's, you know, working people, middle class people. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the tax credits and breaks for people at getting high-end property, it just went absolutely opposite direction, way up. If we don't correct that, suburbs and cities by themselves will not be able to change this.
What about outfits like Airbnb and HomeAway and all those? Are they a problem for you? Are they putting, you know, not just affluent people from your town, but from all over the world in your town taking up housing space?
Sure. So we're in the process. So that is a danger. It's been a real problem, as you know, in other cities. We're in the process of being sure that we regulate it. We're being in the process that we tax them, just like hotel rooms get taxed, that we don't have entire neighborhoods or buildings being used just for that. So it's one thing to rent that a room in your house or rent that mother-in-law apartment in your house. It's another to buy a place and just use it as a hotel. So we are in the process of stepping that up because that could become a huge pressure.
Let's go to Stanley in Worcester, Massachusetts, just in our backyard here. Stanley, you're on the air with the mayor of Seattle, sir.
Yes, what the mayor says is very interesting. I'll tell you, Tom, I'm involved very much at the high end of the market, working in places like ComEd, Back Bay, redoing many of those townhouses, many multi-million dollar projects, as well as Stockbridge and Great Barrington. And I lay that down for you because what I've seen is that from the whole middle part of the state, I'll say from Worcester over to Springfield, workers cannot find work doing any kind of construction unless they're willing to actually take the ride to those very high-end areas like Stockbridge and work there as tradespeople, or to come into Boston and work in, you know, Back Bay, ComEd, those areas.
So it's all high-end or nothing, you're saying, Stanley?
That's what I'm seeing. It's either high-end, feast or famine. That's the first thing I wanted to say to you, Tom. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. I've seen it for a while. And, it astounds me. Men are literally, you know, out of business, and their old firms have come to me. They said, can we work for you?
Yep.
Because I have these jobs.
Yep.
And the money is no object at the high end. I'm astounded sometimes myself where it comes from. But then there's the other thing I wanted to actually throw on the table. For the longest time, we've had almost 0% interest rates, effectively, for about 5 or 6 years. That was in principle to help stoke a market to maybe get things back in place. And the government, the Fed, has told us there's no inflation, but yet everything that we're talking about today points to significant inflation, misallocation of resources. Money has gone to places to drive businesses, which has pushed has pushed business along, but it hasn't found its way to, let's say, the common man.
Stanley, let me ask why that is. I really appreciate your call. Neela, what about it? Almost zero interest rates, and very historically low mortgage rates. You would think that would have produced a lot more activity here in this last half dozen years.
You know, Tom, what I always say to this question is it doesn't matter how low rates go. If you can't get a loan, you can't get a loan. And that's what we've seen for a long time, that the mortgage industry was very credit constrained. There was a lot of fear to extend credit to first-time buyers and many people who didn't have stellar credit ratings. And we saw the impact of that. There was also some restrictions among banks and initially lending to builders. What we've also seen is that the federal government has taken a back step when it comes to financing low-income properties as private lending has gone. Now, we want private lending in the market. That's a healthy market. But private lending tends to focus on the high end, and the need is at the low and affordable end, and that's the problem.
Did you think, Mayor Murray, that those very low mortgage rates would just make things happen on their own? Were you surprised that they didn't?
No, I'm not, and I think the last speaker pointed it out. Without the Fed's involved at the low end, it's not going to happen by itself.
And I mean, the low end is hardly just poverty here. You've got, as our last caller said, middle class people
right.
Nowhere to go.
And that's at the heart of what we're trying to do in Seattle. You know, somebody who works in cleaning hotel rooms now has to live outside the city and drive for hours, or somebody who works in one of our hospitals takes buses for hours. That's what we're trying to get at by creating the supply at the low and affordable end.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American rents, why they're sky high, and what's going on with the American housing market, too many now paying more than half their income on rent, and many, many more than the third that people say should be the limit these days. Renters, you can join us this hour. How far, how low have you had to go to find a place you could afford? And builders, if the market is so strong, why aren't you building more apartments, more homes? We'll hear in just a moment from a developer in New Jersey about how she's trying to wrestle with all this. Mayor Ed Murray of Seattle is with us. Seattle's been a leader in trying to aggressively combat this. They've been also a leader in high rents, and they've been working hard to try and break through and do something about it. He joins us today from Seattle, and it's great to have you, Mayor Murray. Neela Richardson is with us, chief economist at Redfin National Real Estate Brokerage. We'll hear in just a moment from Christiana Foglio in New Jersey, but a couple calls from around the country first. Let's go to Michael in Madison, Wisconsin. Michael, you're on.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
It's all right. What do you see there in Madison?
So, yeah, in Madison, it's kind of funny because people have been viewing Madison as a really progressive city. And from a rental perspective, it's really not. I've definitely been seeing vacancy rates were sub 1% in some places for vacancy rate for rental apartments. It's really hard to get an apartment. I'm currently paying just above a third for where I'm living in Madison. And really what's missing a lot in Madison, I feel like, is low-income development. Recently, Epic Systems moved near Madison.
Yeah.
And all of those jobs are kicking out about $50,000 a year, pretty much no matter what you're doing. So developers are developing in the city for those jobs, and they're not developing any low-income housing.
How old are you, Michael?
I'm 24 years old.
You know, you hear people talk about these days millennials having big student loan debts and then high rents on top of that, and it amounting to a kind of rent loan serfdom there. You get stuck just paying for that.
Right. Yeah, I can't imagine having to pay. If I was paying anything more than the third of my income that I'm paying right now, there wouldn't really be any option for me other than to go find a job elsewhere and go move to another city with lower rents.
Michael, I'm going to take that to Mayor Murray about young people in Seattle and elsewhere and how they're supposed to make a go of it. But first, a couple more here. Chris in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Chris, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much. Back in the 60s and 70s, when I was in college and then working in New York, we always had that figure that one quarter of your total income was supposed to be spent for rent. One quarter, not one third.
Okay, even less.
Now, we weren't making any money back then.
Still, a quarter's a quarter, no matter what you're making.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the fact is that I have a friend in New York who has started making a lot of money and then retired, and she has a condominium in New York, which is $1,800 a month. And she can have that for the rest of her life for $1,800 when it's now, for anybody that comes into that condominium, is $4,400.
It must be rent control, or does she own it?
It's under rent control.
Yeah, yeah, all kinds of inequities come in here. But it used to be a quarter as a max. Now we're talking a third, and many gone to a half and more. And that's just a lot. One more right here. Jose in Marietta, Georgia. Jose, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yes, sir. This issue here is so important to the little people and hardly noticed by the big people. And, the Republican platform, I think, is a house of cards. And you pull one out and it collapses. And to me, the basic tenet is the market is self-regulating. Don't mess with the market. You know, just let the market be. And I don't see any self-regulating market going on with the rental stuff and the housing stuff and all that. And keep minimum wage just as it is. Don't touch it. It's it'll cost lots of jobs. And people can't get an affordable rent with the minimum wage. You know, people at the lower tier. And Bernie Sanders is like basically the only person addressing this issue. Republicans don't even go there. You know, why should they?
Jose, let us pick it up. Ed Murray, you're listening to all this. You've been in politics a long time. There's Michael, 24 years old, and you hear what he's up against in Madison, Wisconsin. And Chris saying, look, it used to be a quarter of your income was all you should spend. Now way over that. And you hear Jose, he said the system is just not working. The market's not working here. Your thoughts, Mayor, as you hear these callers from around the country?
Yeah, and obviously we've already mentioned that it seems like the federal role in this is pretty paralyzed and pretty dysfunctional. You know, getting at the young man from Madison, the first thing we did in 2014, my first year in office, was to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We're phasing that in, particularly for small businesses, but we led the nation on that. Income inequality is part of the problem here. Next is a series of things we're doing in our city, given our laws and in our state, that work for us that we believe will increase the stock. Other cities will do different things given their own regulatory environment. But whether it's our housing levy, where we're going to ask the voters to double it this year to build that affordable housing, whether it's requiring developers to build affordable units in every building they build, whether it is working on discrimination against tenants based on their criminal history or their source of income, it is all of these things together that cities can do to start to change the curve on this, to start to create more affordable stock. And actually our goal, and we're a city of about 670,000 people, our goal is to build 50,000 units over the next 10 years, 20,000 at that low-end affordable, which is triple of what we're doing today. Cities can do that. And actually I would say cities, or my colleagues around the nation, are doing this, not just Bernie Sanders, but mayors.
Make it a local effort, but there's an appeal at the same time for federal policy that would help out.
Yeah, can I emphasize that point?
Mm-hmm.
The history of this country, particularly beginning with FDR, is it is local governments in relationship with the federal government that actually get these things started. The ideas that came out of New York in the 30s became the national policy when FDR went into office. And you see that same thing throughout our history. And without that relationship, we can continue to be the incubators, come up with the ideas, but we need someone to take it to scale.
Mayor Murray in Seattle, it's great to have you there. Neela Richardson with Redfin, please stand by. I want to get a developer in this conversation. I mean, after all, more building would mean more units, and presumably that would bring rents down. Christiana Folio joins us from Lawrenceville, New Jersey, founder, CEO of Community Investment Strategies. She was former executive director for the New Jersey Housing and Mortgage Finance Agency, has been in the middle of this whole thing for a long time now, but she's a developer now, owns something like her firm, 3,000 units in New Jersey, kind of a moderate-sized builder by New Jersey standards. Christiana Folio, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You're a developer who's interested in building lower and middle income housing. What's stopping you from doing more? Or maybe there aren't impediments for you.
Well, I think the mayor hit the nail on the head. It's really the exit of the federal government in terms of the major programs that even we saw in the 90s have been cut. It takes 4 to 5 years for an affordable housing developer to actually puzzle together all the different pieces of funding that you now have to go after. And for the first time, to be honest, I'm now competing with market rate builders of rental housing on properties that normally would not have been in an interest to market rate developers. So I think the opportunities for people like me who build affordable housing, the lack of funding, and then just the stamina, the financial stamina to invest $500,000 for approvals before you have all your financing really makes it quite difficult, I think, for firms like myself to aggressively attack the needs that we find.
Chris, why do you think you need all these subsidies, maybe half a dozen different kinds of subsidies to make it work? Why doesn't the market itself work here? There's clearly a big demand. There's a lot of people who need housing. And why doesn't supply and demand just bring these rates down?
Well, I think Nila really brought us through, you know, the whole idea of wages just not keeping pace with rents. In New Jersey, a typical rent in the a building that I build for a two-bedroom, let's say, is about $1,100, and that's an affordable rent where someone is supposedly only spending 30% of their income on rent. However, in reality, I think we all kind of understand that it's much more than 30%, as you pointed out. And very interesting, I look at my, you know, the population of people that we serve, and I would say in the larger metropolitan areas where we work, usually 50 to 60% are healthcare workers who are hourly workers that are holding down, you know, three, sometimes four jobs in order to make ends meet. So it's really that whether you're at the lower end of the pay scale or the middle, you really just can never get ahead and really keep it in that 30% range.
Nila Richardson, it almost sounds as though there's a big chunk of earners who are in a kind of headlock here. It's not 25% anymore. It's a third or a half or more. And there's no way out. The market's not giving them a way out. They're just squeezed for life. What happened to the more, I don't know, fluid market that would take this into account and accommodate them?
You know, just to put some numbers around this problem that I think Christiana really illustrated well, the number of low-income apartments have increased 10% over the past several years, but the number of low-income renters has increased by four times that amount, 40%. So, again, highlighting that mismatch. And, you know, inflation is actually kind of a misleading indicator of where the economy is. Inflation is basically meant to many middle-class and low-income families that their wages haven't increased. That's what the inflation being really low is meant for the average Joe. But what has increased are rental prices, healthcare, education, and that is really the growing concern that is being illustrated here. People are economically trapped, and yet housing used to be the way the middle class built wealth. It used to be a place where you can reach community and economic opportunity, and so that's really, really the reason why it's so important that communities and local leaders find their footing on this issue.
You heard Jose in Atlanta saying, from where he sits, it looks like the system just isn't working if people are that far over a barrel and the market doesn't respond.
And that's why it's so surprising that this isn't more of a political issue. We've advocated at Redfin that this is the issue for the middle class. Housing is, because it affects everybody. We've seen increases in renters, not just low income, not just middle class, not just millennials, but all across the income and demographic spectrum, people with professional jobs, as you've seen from the call today, people in the healthcare field are not being able to live where they work. And that is an issue.
Samantha in Canton, Ohio. Samantha, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, I'm Tom. I just wanted to confirm and agree with everything that's been said. Even if I could get a loan with a really low interest rate, which, you know, especially our parents say, oh, that's such a good deal, you really need to take advantage of that. Well, I don't have the 25% down, and plus you've got to think of all of the other things that you have to worry about, taxes and insurance and education and childcare. There's so many other factors going into it that I would not, I wouldn't do it. Renting is not ideal for me, but it is the only option for housing at this point.
How old are you, if I may ask, Samantha?
29.
And do you expect to own a home at some point, or do you see renting for the long term?
I would love to own. My 5 or 10 year goal eventually would be that we own it outright without a mortgage, because that is such a big portion of our budget. If that were eliminated, I feel like, you know, we could afford so many other things.
Boy, if you can pull that off in 5 to 10 years, you'll be a real champ. But that is hard to do. And Chris Folio, especially when just to get the down payment together, if the rent is high, even getting a down payment together can be a huge challenge, Chris.
Right, you're stuck. And, you know, in picking up that whole idea of this is across the board, it affects younger people and older people, I'm currently kind of referring it to the senior squeeze. We just opened an affordable senior project in New Jersey, and we had to turn away half of the seniors because they made too much money, but they were too rich to be able to get into affordable housing and too poor to stay in their town and get market rate housing. I'm sure the mayor has also faced that with his elderly population, that they just can't even stay in the communities that they have called their home for, you know, 50, 60 years.
Mayor Murray, you focus as much on this as anyone in the country. Do you think Seattle is getting around the corner on this, or are you really still waiting for needing federal intervention to change the picture?
We're gonna make an impact, and we will build those units that I identified. But think about the multifamily tax exemption that we have. That if a developer develops an affordable unit or uses that tax credit, they develop an affordable unit. Imagine if we had a federal partner, we could build twice that many units. Washington State has something called the Housing Trust Fund. There's an idea about this in D.C., but imagine if we had federal partners with that Housing Trust Fund, we could build twice as many units.
Well, as everybody listens to the debates and talks with the candidates and gives their 2 cents, maybe with a conversation like this, we can begin to push this back closer to the center of the conversation. Mayor Murray, it sounds like it's, in your view and many others, it's pretty important.
Very important. It actually should be the most important item in the presidential debates this year. Affordable housing for the middle class, that's what defines the middle class.
Mayor Ed Murray of Seattle, who's been in the thick of this, we're very grateful to you for having been with us today, Mayor Murray. Thanks for joining us. Chris Folio in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, Community Investment Strategies. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris. And Neela Richardson at Redfin, chief economist there in Washington. Neela, you're terrific. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, we've got the New Hampshire primaries tomorrow. We will be live from New Hampshire. My colleague Jack Beatty has been there for days and days now, covering the last days of campaigning. You can sign up for his Notes from New Hampshire newsletter at our website. Don't miss it. OnPointRadio.org. Sign up and get the inside track from Jack Beatty there. We'll be live from New Hampshire tomorrow. See you then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.